This message is brought to you by Desiring God. For more information, please visit desiringgod.org.
Well, it really is a delight and pleasure for me to be able to join you. As you can gather from my accent, I'm not from these parts. But I do love the United States. I've been here many times. It seems that I've been moving increasingly north in terms of my visits. My first few visits to this nation were into the state of Georgia, where our ministry is headquartered. And I just fell in love with the people there and the culture. They gave me grits for breakfast. That's such a novel food. It not only feeds you, but it brushes your teeth at the same time. And I think this may be about as far north in the United States of America as I've probably preached. Now, I would also like just to start this as well as this also with a word of thanks, because it's been a privilege for me to be associated with the Desiring God Ministries part of what's been going on here for, I don't know, maybe starting about 10 years ago, in a very minor role, where at one point John Piper's tapes were being distributed in Europe, and that was happening out of the UK, and they needed some board members, and they couldn't find any good ones, so I ended up doing that. And as a result, as a gift, I got given a complete set of everything he'd written. And then every year, I got everything else that he had written. And I am just so grateful for that. And if any of you here would understand that your primary calling is an evangelist, as I would, then you really have to make theology your hobby. And that, therefore, makes us very dependent on those who can help bring clarity to what is the gospel that we're actually preaching. And, you know, I've quoted John more times than I care to remember, and sometimes I even attribute it so they understand it wasn't me. And so it is a great pleasure, and it is a great privilege simply to be part of what's going on here. Now, what's also been interesting for me is as I was preparing this message was trying to think, okay, how do I put the emphasis on a message where the scope is so broad? Courage, Christ, and finishing the mission. And my initial reaction was to say, well, I should really focus on the whole issue about who is Christ and who is sending us. And as I prayed about that, I thought, I'm not sure that's really where, in terms of what I'm being asked to bring here, is where I should put the focus, which would be the most logical thing, just looking at the title. And I was listening to Louis Giglio yesterday, thinking, I'm so glad, A, I didn't put the focus on my message here, because that's exactly the question you're asking, and B, the only way that I'm going to be able to somehow speak alongside this is if maybe I convince John Piper to do an interpretive dance while I'm preaching. Because I was also, just like David, a little bit concerned about this whole whale song thing and the pulsars and everything else, thinking, you know, this is a challenge to communicate into this context. So then, as I continued to work through, I thought, well, what I should maybe do is really talk about how we understand the gospel, the glory of God, the lostness of man, and therefore the imperative we have to finish the mission. And I was praying about that, and I wrote three different messages along that theme, and none of them I just thought, I'm not sure, it was all correct, and absolutely, it really should be part of. This talk was to be a complete in and of itself, would absolutely have to be there, and I just didn't seem to be the place to put the emphasis. And I was listening to David this morning thinking, well, I mean, it was fantastic this morning. It was glorious. It was wonderful. And thinking, well, God, I'm just so glad that, first of all, I didn't put that emphasis there. And I'm so glad that that's been addressed already. And so that, therefore, leaves then the part on the courage. Now, I'm going to touch, obviously, on the other aspects of this just for the sake of a completeness to it. But what I would like to do is I would really like to try and start off by speaking into this issue of courage. And I would like to ask a question. Actually, I'd like to ask a couple of questions, which I found myself asking as I was preparing this. Number one, if we were to take the finances from my local church that I'm a part of and put it together with the calendar that we have of everything that we do and send it to a group of non-Christian management consultants, and say, analyze our finances, analyze our time, and you come back and tell us what you think our priorities in life are. I'm wondering to what extent they would conclude that to go and make disciples was actually a key part of how we understood who we were about. And I'm wondering, I found myself extending that, as we look at the church, To what extent is the evidence there that would demonstrate that actually this is a core understanding of why we're here? Would it be deducible or not? Now, the second question I also find myself asking was that when we think about courage, the first thing we do is we often think about the challenging situations in the world where people are literally losing their life for the gospel, and to talk about the courage that we see there as an inspiration to us. And again, I think there's some legitimacy in that, and it's wonderful to hear the testimonies. It can be very, very encouraging. And we're going to do a little bit of that as well. But then I began to be concerned about a distance issue. So one question was, is it obvious that we have this concern for the nations? Or is this concern simply to even go and make disciples? Is that obvious? Would that be discernible from how we use our time and how we use the resources which have been given to us? But then the other thing I thought was, sort of, if we put the emphasis on this overseas part, and I said we are going to talk something about that, I found myself coming back to another question, which was actually much closer to home, which is, why is it in the Western world we seem to have a crisis of courage? Why is it in the Western world we seem to be so silent at times? Why is it in the Western world it seems like so much of the church have taken a few words that Jesus said to a small group of disciples in a very particular set of circumstances, see to it you tell no one, and therefore, and applied it as some kind of universal mandate to how we should understand how we talk about him. Does that make sense? In other words, why does it seem that there's so little of this? So the message I have may be at times challenging. I hope not too challenging, because I would like it to be inspiring too, but I found myself increasingly disburdened, and I wanted to overcome that challenge of distance. And so I'd like to try to bring it home. So what I'd like to try to do is to phrase a message about courage for the gospel, about, in answer to those questions, why is it that maybe at times we seem to be expending so little effort to go and make disciples? And why is it that even when we think of a title like this, the first thing we do is think of countries thousands of miles away and not about the people who live next door? Now, I think there are lots of reasons why maybe we have a crisis, if you like, of confidence, a crisis of courage, a crisis of being willing to step out for the sake of the gospel at home. And one of them was actually highlighted in the conversation last night in the interview. And that is to do with the sense of intellectual shame that a lot of Christians feel in relationship to the gospel, which is namely that, okay, even though we feel the gospel is true, we're not sure that maybe it is true or could be demonstrated to be true, and so maybe it's true for us. Now, I don't know, has anyone ever said to you, I'm so happy for you that you're a Christian, I wish I could believe what you believe, but I can't? Have you ever heard that? Okay, now this is the softest form of this. Now, I heard that said to me so many times, especially when I first got into ministry, I began reflecting on that sentence. Why is it that so many people are saying this to me? And what I realized is what they were saying was this, is, Michael, there does seem to be a joy in your life, but this joy comes because of your faith in Jesus. But Jesus doesn't exist. You believe in something that isn't there. Now, what do you call people who believe in things that are not there? The answer is mad people. So what they're saying is, Michael, you are insane. But the main thing is that you are happy and insane. Now, I'm happy that you're happy. As a matter of fact, I'm so desperate to know some legitimate source of joy in this world, I too would embrace insanity just to join you, and I've thought about it, but I can't. Now, whatever the gospel is, it is not a plea for wishful thinking. It is not an invitation to believe in something that you would like to be true but actually isn't. It is a plea to respond to a God who is true and who is real, who has revealed himself, who has manifested himself, who has made himself known, who is revealed to us, as we've already heard this morning through creation, who is revealed to us in his word and is revealed to us in his son, and that there has to be a response to that, and the only legitimate response to that is repentance and faith. That is the legitimate response to this gospel and this God who is true and real. Now, when I talk about a sense of our intellectual struggle, I'd like to make a differentiation between two different types of things which can go on, because As I look at how maybe as Christians we sometimes struggle with a sense of this intellectual shame that we had referred to on the platform in the Q&A panel last night, because there are two different forms it takes and they're very, very different. There is a huge difference between the intellectual questions we have that are born from cynicism and skepticism and the kinds of questions which are born out of doubt and confusion. They're very, very different. I don't know if you remember in the beginning of the Gospel of Luke, we have that whole series of angelic appearances. They're fantastic. Now, if we had time, I'll read through all of them. We don't have time to do that. And so let me just give a summary, because there is another larger passage of Scripture I'd like to be able to read later to you out of Hebrews 11. But I'd just like to start here out of Luke 1. Now, if you remember, Gabriel comes, first of all, to Zechariah. And he says, basically, Zechariah, I've got good news. You're going to have a boy. And Zechariah says, well, look, I'm pretty old. My wife is pretty old. How do I know this? And Gabriel looks at Zechariah and says, I am Gabriel. I stand in the presence of God and I have come here to tell you this, and you did not believe me. Therefore, from this time onwards, you will be struck dumb until these words are fulfilled in their correct time. And when he comes out of the temple, he cannot speak. It's not that he has nothing to say. Rather, he is unable to say it. Now, a little bit later, the same angel, Gabriel, goes to see Mary and says, Mary, don't be afraid. You're going to have a boy. Okay? It's good news. And Mary says, how can this be? Because I'm a virgin. And Gabriel says, well, the power of the Almighty will overcome you, and the power of the Spirit will overshadow you, and you will be with child, and he will be the Son of the Most High and will be the Son of God. Now, I don't know if you've ever asked yourself the question, is that fair? In the sense that the gay angel comes to Gabriel and says, you're going to have a boy. And Zechariah says, well, I'm pretty old. My wife is pretty old. And Gabriel says, that's it. You're struck dumb. And then he goes to Mary and says, hey, you're going to have a baby. And she says, well, I haven't slept with anyone. So, you know, how can this be? And he gives an explanation. Now, is that fair? I mean, what happened between those two instances? Now, I suppose one imaginative approach would be to say that Gabriel, you know, came to Zechariah. Good news. I've got some great news for you. You're going to have a boy. He's a bit disappointed with the response. He's a bit new at this. He loses his rag. And he says, okay, that's it, Zechariah. You can't speak anymore. He gets back to heaven and God comes and puts his arm around the angel and says, why don't we have one of those 360-degree job reviews I've heard about? You give me some feedback, I'll give you some feedback. We need to work on your interpersonal skills. So when Gabriel goes to Mary and seems to give a very similar message, and she says, well, I'm a virgin, he sort of breathes in deeply, counts to 10, and says, okay, let me lay it out for you. Now, that would be imaginative. Probably not true to what the text is about at all. And therefore, not what is actually going on. So how is it fair? And the answer is, I believe, if we look closely at this text, is that God is dealing with them differently, because although their questions appear to be very similar, as a matter of fact, in the NIV translation, their two responses are made exactly the same. The ESV correctly puts a slight nuance of difference between the two, which is actually very, very important, is although they appear to be very, very similar, there is something very, very different, because the difference between a question of complete skepticism and cynicism and a question that's born out of doubt and confusion, they are not the same. Now, the parallels are striking. Okay? The angel appears, they are both afraid, which is why the angel says, do not be afraid. So neither of them sees the angel and goes, ooh, angels, wow. I wonder if there are any unicorns about. Okay? They are both respond to this revelation of holiness with terror. They are both frightened. They both are given emotional reassurance. Do not be afraid. This is good news. Okay, they are both told they will have children. They will both have boys. And yet, the responses are so different. Now, questions born out of cynicism and skepticism are never interested in an answer. How will I know this? How can I know this is true? It's different from a question, how will this be? How is this possible? Let me just try to explain what I mean. In a cynicism, anything that's related to the gospel, and we live in a very cynical culture today, will be written off as chance. Answered prayer, chance. Fulfilled prophecy, chance. As soon as we write things off as chance, we're basically making them meaningless. Now, our culture has become so cynical in our contemporary age that even language itself has been put down to a thing of chance, which makes even meaningful communication impossible. Everything becomes meaningless. And we're not interested in truth anymore. A couple of years ago, I had the pleasure of meeting a guy called Anthony Flew. Now, I was interested to meet him because Anthony Flew was a well-known atheist who wrote the most widely reprinted philosophical essay of the 20th century. Anthony Flew, who debated C.S. Lewis and was widely considered to have won that debate, wrote up the proceeds of that debate into an essay called Theology and Falsification. His father had been a minister, and he turned away from the faith. Now, Anthony Flew popularized a lot of arguments against the Christian faith. One of them was this: if you give enough monkeys typewriters, eventually they'll produce the works of Shakespeare. You ever heard that? Now, Anthony Flew was once debating a Christian, and a Christian actually pointed out to him that someone had done some research on this. Believe it or not, the British Academy gave a grant to a group of PhD students to put a typewriter in a cage with a group of monkeys and leave it there for a while and see what happened. Now, apart from using it as a toilet, the monkeys produced 6 typed pages, but not one single word, which is remarkable when you consider that the shortest word in the English language is A or I. However, to qualify as a word, the word had to have a space either side of it, and therefore, if you have a keyboard with 30 keys, the chance of randomly producing a one-letter word would be 1 in 27,000. Now, forget about reproducing the works of Shakespeare. What would be the chance on this basis, a monkey, or a group of monkeys in this case, with a typewriter, randomly producing one Shakespearean sonnet, which by definition, by the way, are all 14 lines long? So the researchers took the Shakespearean sonnet, "Shall I Compare Thee to a Summer's Day?" 14 lines of poetry, 288 characters. What is the chance of randomly generating 288 characters in sequence? Now, the answer is 1 divided by 1 with 690 zeros after it. Now, unless you're a banker or perhaps a televangelist, you'll find it hard to imagine that number. So let me try to spell it out for you. If you were to take every particle in the universe, and we're not talking about grains of sand, we're talking about protons, neutrons, and electrons. If you were to take every particle in the universe, and just remember Louis Giglio's slides yesterday, and how we all seen a small portion of the sky, not all of it, but if you could take all of the mass in the universe and break it down all into neutrons, protons, and electrons and count them individually, to our best guess, it's about 10 to the power of 80. That's 10 with 80 zeros after it. That's the number of particles. There are not enough protons, neutrons, and electrons to randomly write down the trials. Or, let's put it another way. Let's suppose you took all of the mass in the universe and you were to convert it into microchips. Each microchip weighs 1 millionth of a gram. Every microchip randomly produced 1 million times a second random combinations of 288 letters. And let us assume that those computers, weighing a millionth of a gram, producing 1 million random calculations of 288 combinations, have been running since time itself began. And for the sake of this illustration, we'll go for an old Earth theory. Under those conditions, we would have randomly produced 10 to the power of 90 random trials. The universe would have to be 10, with 600 zeros after it, times older than even our oldest guess of the age of the universe to randomly produce, on this basis, one Shakespearean sonnet. Apparently, monkeys can do it every time. Now, Anthony Flew, when he came across this and this was presented to him, he found his world rocked. You see, it was so easy just to say, well, it's just random, it's just chance, you know. It's inevitable. We can easily imagine these monkeys producing Shakespeare. And if you read some of the books written by some of the new atheists, you wonder if they have been written by monkeys randomly typing away. Some of them seem to support one theory of the universe, which is that the total amount of intelligence in the world is fixed, but the population is growing. But that's a whole other area we won't get into. It's very easy to write it off. And all of a sudden, Anthony Flew found himself confronted by a rather inconvenient line of argument. Now, he didn't suddenly conclude that Jesus Christ was God, but he went to write a book. Now, you have to remember, Anthony Flew, up until the beginning of this millennia, was considered to be the philosophical leader for the new atheist movement. Richard Dawkins, Peter Harris, all of these guys referenced him. As a matter of fact, if you went to the secular website or the Humanist Society's website, his basic book on philosophy was the basic textbook recommended for all good atheist agnostics to read in the field of what's called epistemology. How do we know what is happening? What is true? And how do we know it? Now, after he wrote this book, he fell out of favor with them, and he was removed from the recommended reading list because the next book he wrote was called There Is a God, After All. Now, what is interesting, as I said, when you look at Zechariah, somehow he bodily outlives this fact that without God, language just simply even disappears. And as Zechariah here asks this question of complete skepticism, he finds he can't speak at all. Now, there is a clue, further clue, that's a differentiation between what's happening here with Zechariah and Mary. And it happens if you read, obviously, from chapter 1, verse 9 of the Gospel of Luke very carefully, where when the angel appears to Zechariah, what he actually says is, Zechariah, I am Gabriel. He says, Zechariah, your prayer has been heard, and your wife, Elizabeth, will bear you a son. Now, this is amazing. This changes everything. Gabriel, when he comes to Zechariah, unlike Mary, who was not praying, by the way, for, you know, immaculate conception, Zechariah was praying for a child. We know this because Gabriel says, your prayer has been heard, and your wife Elizabeth will bear you a son. So I guess we could go into the Greek and do some fancy hermeneutics, but I think it's safe to conclude from the text that Zechariah was praying for a child. So forget about atheistical skepticism at the moment. This is theistic skepticism. Zechariah, a priest in the temple, has been praying and asking God for a son, or for a child. We don't know if it's a son. Maybe he was asking for a son. It wouldn't be unreasonable in this culture to assume it was, but a child. An angel comes to him and says, good news. Your prayer has been heard. God is going to deliver. You're going to have a boy. And Zechariah says, how will I know this? Seriously? You've been praying and asking God, give me. And this is, if you have wrestled with the issue of childlessness, these are the kinds of issues that cause tears, sleepless nights, on your knees begging God, please, Lord, help. Answer our prayer. May we have a child. And now an angel comes. Your prayer is finally heard. And Zechariah's response is, how can I know this? Now, both Mary's objection or question and Zechariah's question are rooted, actually, scientifically. They both have biological objections to the angel's message, right? This is biology 101. Zechariah, I'm old. My wife is old. Do the maths. Babies. Very remote chance. Now, Zechariah should have known better, because if he'd been reading his Old Testament, he would know that God actually has a history of delivering babies to, you know, unlikely people, regardless of age. But, you know, let's just leave that aside. Mary's objection is also scientifically grounded. I'm a virgin. I haven't known a man. To have a baby? Now, if you're confused about this, Pastor John will deal with this in the Q&A. and he'll explain to you what's going on. But please hear the point here. They both have scientific objections to the divine revelation as to what God can actually do. But Zechariah's question is not a question that's going to permit an answer. And his skepticism in the face of this revelation invites judgment. Mary, however, is simply confused. She hasn't been praying. She hasn't been asking. The angel comes. She has a question of legitimate confusion. I don't understand how this is biologically possible. The necessary steps have not been fulfilled. And the angel says, let me explain to you how this will happen. As I was preparing this message and running through it again last night and first thing this morning, you have to forgive me if at times I ask too many challenging questions. I can't help it. I'm an evangelist. That's what we're programmed to do. God made it that way. I couldn't help asking myself the question, is it possible that some of us are here today and we're asking God for the nations? We're asking, we're looking to him to do something, to move. And the simple truth is that even if Gabriel himself came and stood in front of us and said, your prayer has been heard, we would respond in exactly the same way. Is it possible that there are some of you in this room and God has been calling you? He's been calling you for a while. And you're busily praying away. It's a dangerous place to be. It's a dangerous place to be. In our day and age, there are a lot of scientific objections to God, but most of them are completely misunderstood. There is no intellectual shame. There should be no hesitation in our hearts or minds as to the truth and the reality of the gospel that has been given to us, or even indeed of the nature of it, or how it relates to science, or indeed anything else. So because it's become such a contemporary issue, and I believe it's one of the issues that seems to have so many Christians running for cover, I just want to just pick up just two issues where I feel that this Christians have been feel that they're being forced into silence to say nothing, because they're fearful that actually maybe this doesn't ultimately make sense and this isn't ultimately true. So let me just pick up on two. First one, which is very common, is to say, well, look, we don't need God anymore. We've got science. Science will answer all of these questions. Now, one of my colleagues, John Lennox, wrote a very good book recently in response to a guy called Professor Stephen Hawking, who I'm sure many of you will know, who basically came and said, look, because of this thing called M theory, which is sort of a fairly controversial field of mathematics, because of this, we know that the universe can and will create itself from nothing due to the effect of gravity. Now, I don't have time to go into all of this statement, but let's just assume that actually Stephen Hawking is correct in saying that he can mathematically model the creation of the universe from zero. And let us assume that there is no error, there is no mistake, that the model works 100%. It explains everything. There is nothing which is not explained. Does that therefore mean that there is no God? Even if it were true, which I think it's not. I don't think what he claims for his theory was actually going to be able to do what he says it can, but even if it were, I flew here on a plane. It's a big metal thing with engines. I don't like flying. It keeps my prayer life healthy. Now, there is nothing on that aeroplane that cannot be explained through scientific law. Does that make sense? Every function, every part of that plane, every aspect of it, everything can be mathematically modeled and explained with a mixture of physics, chemistry, maths, pure mathematics. We can model 100%. There is nothing unknown. Does that make sense? There's no gap. There's no for God to fill. Everything about that plane, from how it takes off to how it lands, everything about it can be explained with science. There is no hole. There's no gap for God to fill. However, the very fact, and even though we can explain the aeroplane in this way, does that in any way tell us that there was no one who built it? Or there was no intelligent mind behind it? You see, there is a big difference between the idea of what's called law and agency. Law describes how things are. Agency tells us whether anyone was involved in doing anything. So even if it were possible for us scientifically to model the operation of this universe with complete accuracy, every law, every interrelation, everything, in no way does that tell us or answer the question, is there a mind behind this? As a matter of fact, it may be very strong evidence to suggest that there is a mind behind this. You with me? Is this too complicated for Saturday morning? You need more coffee. It simply wouldn't be true, even if we were able to do it. If we had an exhaustively scientific model of this universe, the question as to whether or not there is a God would not be settled by that. As a matter of fact, the second thing, which is related to this, is even more important. Now, it's a shame that C.S. Lewis came up with this argument all these years ago, because it seems a lot of the people who are currently writing books in this area have forgotten what Lewis actually had to say, because he actually answered a question that's been raised by Stephen Hawking, but he answered it about 50, 60 years too early. The second one goes like this. Because we have a scientific understanding of this universe and we understand the laws and the principles by which it operates, therefore God cannot intervene. Because if God intervened, he would be violating the laws of nature. And the laws of nature cannot possibly be violated. Now, does this hold? And the answer is no. Lewis put it like this. He said, let's suppose you take £1,000 and £1,000 and you put it in your bedside table. Let me convert that into dollars. $1,613 and $1,613, and you put it in your bedside table. When you open the drawer in the morning, there should be £2,000 there, right? What happens if you open the drawer and there's only £1,000 there? What do you conclude? That the laws of mathematics have been broken? No, you conclude the laws of the land have been broken. Someone broke into your bedroom and took $1,000 out of your drawer. Sorry, excuse the increase in pitch in my voice. It's a delayed adolescence. It is because the maths is uniform and operates without exception that we are able to detect the presence of an intruder who came in and interfered in the system. It is because we live in a universe governed by uniform laws that we are able to detect when God has intervened. And when he has done something. If we lived in a random universe, when random things happened, all we can conclude is that it was random. But because we live in an orderly universe and a governed universe, when Mary falls pregnant, it's not that the laws have been broken. The very fact that she understands the science behind how you get pregnant and that hasn't been fulfilled means that something else must have taken place which got her pregnant to be able to have the baby. You still with me? You want me to start again from the beginning? Mary and Zechariah both have a scientific objection. Zechariah's question is, I think, so they say, I'm convinced, born out of a position of complete skepticism. He'd been praying for this, and so when the answer is announced, he still won't accept it. How can I know this? Mary, it comes out of the blue. She has no idea. She says, how is this possible? And God says, well, this is how it will go. And she responds in worship. Now, this is a very happy story. This is why evangelists like this passage, okay? Because Zechariah's story also ends in worship, right? The baby's born, his mouth is opened, and he praises God. Okay, that's the kind of stories that evangelists like to tell. 100% response rate, genuine worship before God. W- We need to take the time and the effort in this culture to know that this gospel is true. To understand that the questions which people bring about that come from confusion can actually be dealt with and answered. Could you answer them? If someone asked you, why are you a Christian? Could you answer it? Have you ever noticed when people are asked why they are Christians, they respond by saying how they became a Christian? Have you ever noticed that? Well, I met this person, they gave me a book, I went to their church, you know, I heard this message, I became a Christian. What does that sound like to a non-Christian? Have you ever thought that? Doesn't it sound very random again? If you met a Muslim that day, and he gave you a Quran, and invited you to the mosque, you'd be a Muslim, right? So that's the explanation. Chance. Lucky you. You believe that? It also sounds a bit like brainwashing, doesn't it? You met this person, they persuaded you, you responded to their persuasion, now you're a Christian, you've been brainwashed. One of my friends, when he became a Christian, his mother said to him, you've been brainwashed. He looked at his mother and said, if you knew what was in my brain, you'd be glad it's been washed. Is that the answer? I had a lucky break. How we became a Christian and why this is true, they're not the same question and they do not deserve the same answer. Can we respond to the honest questions in our culture which are born of confusion? And so long as we're running scared that maybe this is not true, we'll run from them. But we have no need to feel that shame. This is true. Now, the second source of shame, and we're not going to have time to go into this in huge detail, is moral shame. Now, I'm not talking about moral issues so much in our culture, although most Christians feel they're on the wrong end of every moral debate. But it seems to me, in the Western world at least, there's a sense of moral shame connected with the gospel. When we're asked questions like, if your God is so loving, why couldn't he just forgive us? Doesn't that seem reasonable? Or, why does Christ have to die on the cross in order for us to be forgiven? Why is that necessary? Now, those are huge questions. I'm wondering how many Christians in the average church could answer those two questions correctly. Could you? It surprises me that so many Christians are scared of being asked a question like that when we should be rejoicing that someone's asked us a question like that. That is a great question. Thank you for asking me that. I'd love to talk with you about God's love and God's justice. I would love to talk to you about the necessity of the cross, why there was no other way. That, what a gift of a question. I love these questions. I was in a country I can't name. This is, in case the guy's about to stop the streaming, you can leave this bit in. I was speaking to a group of people who had very successfully bombed a nightclub in a part of the world. And from a non-Christian persuasion. And I got to do a 3-hour Q&A with 1,000 of their students and their 2 leading professors of Islam. And before I went in, I remember praying and saying, Lord, please at the end, may the last question come to me and may it be about this. And God was gracious enough to allow someone to ask me a question to which I already knew the answer. And by the way, if you're nervous about speaking to people about the gospel, then why not try praying that prayer? God, could they try asking me some questions to which I've already got the answers and then help me with the other ones which I don't know? And so the question came. What a gift. What a gift. As I was answering the question, several hundred of the students as we got to the point about why Christ had been crucified on the cross just suddenly broke down into floods of tears. And afterwards, one of the Muslim professors came up to me and poked me in the chest and they said, they should have warned us about you. And then he said, they told us you were from Oxford University. And, you know, we teach at Oxford University. So he said, you weren't meant to be interesting. What does that say about education today? Now, I could give a whole talk just short, purely on this moral issue. But the simple truth is, so long as we remain so theologically confused about the basic moral questions about God and the primary objections that most people have, the primary struggle that most people have about the gospel in the Western world is moral. And this is both outside the church and inside the church. Why isn't God more obvious? If he wants us to believe in him, why doesn't he just, you know, every day, you know, 6 p.m. broadcast from heaven to us? That would do it, right? Or why doesn't God sort of lend us angels on rotation? Everybody gets Gabriel for a week. You know, so one week it's David Platt's turn and Gabriel comes along and you go door knocking with him. You knock on the door. Hi, we're here from the local church. We want to tell you about Jesus. They're about to slam it. Gabriel puts his foot in the door. He suddenly grows to 5 times what his size was before. He withdraws his angelic sword, which is flashing with light. And as he slowly turns it in his hands, he says, we would really like to come in and talk with you. I mean, wouldn't that help? Why isn't he more obvious? Why does he allow all this suffering? How can this loving God judge us? These are all moral complaints about God's character. The primary number of struggles people have in the Western world to do with the gospel and with the scripture is moral. And that seems to me to be just as true within the church as without the church. Therefore, how desperately do we need to get a clear understanding of what these questions are? Let me ask you, those questions I just gave you, why isn't God more obvious? Why does God allow suffering? What about people who haven't heard? How can a loving God judge us? Is there anyone here who has never been asked that question? One of those questions. Just put up your hand. Don't be ashamed if you've never been asked a question like that. I don't see any hands, but if you put your hand up, shame on you. You're not going out at all. You can't be. You must be somehow, I don't know, living in the middle of nowhere. We already know what the questions are. They're not surprising. We actually know what the questions are before they've been asked. However, there is one question that I think has led to a complete, or one issue, I should say, in our culture that has led to a complete lack of courage in the face of the gospel. Or in the light of, sorry, of our duty to explain the gospel, which isn't primarily intellectual or moral in its nature, but it is this. We live in a very affluent culture in the West. We're very rich. We're very comfortable. I don't know how many of you have ever heard of a guy called Professor John Gray. Now, there are two Professor John Grays. There's one who wrote a book called Men Are From Mars and Women Are From Venus. I'm not talking about him. I haven't read his book. There's another Professor John Gray, who's the professor of the history of political thought at the London School for Economics, who wrote a book called Straw Dogs. Now, he's an atheist. Now, what's amazing with this John Gray is that he and I agree about everything apart from one thing. Does God exist or not? Now, as soon as you move beyond that question, we're on exactly the same page. What Gray argues is that he is an atheist who hates humanism. The reason he says he hates humanism as an atheist is that he says humanism is basically Christianity dressed up in secular terms, and I would agree with him. Now, he says that we live in a universe where there is actually no sense at all. He says the trouble with humanism is it's bothered about human rights, and there can be no such thing as human rights or human dignity or human persons because it doesn't make sense with the science. He's saying as an atheist, how can you believe in any of those things? He says you can't believe in any of those things. None of those things make sense without God. He says you can believe Christians
for forgiving, for believing in the myth that there is something sacred about human life because they believe we were created in the image of God. But if there is no God in whose image we can be created of, how can we maintain that myth? He says we can't. What Gray says, therefore, is we are all animals. The strong prey on the weak. And then what he goes on to say is we need a political economy that reflects the scientific truth that the strong prey on the weak. And then he goes on to say that the Western world has been held back from world domination and killing everybody else, even though it's more stronger than everybody else, because it's being weakened by this Christian faith, this Christian idea that somehow you can't do that, that would be morally wrong. Are you with me? And so he says we need a political economy that would be consistent with a strict form of scientific atheism. Now, I find what he says very, very scary, but there is something which he says which I think he's absolutely spot on, and this is how he phrases it. He's saying, the trouble is, however, is that morality is a convenience that makes us feel comfortable and we cling on to it. I think that's true. Most parents would like their children to be respectful, to be honest, because it makes their life easier. It's convenient. And then he goes on to say something else. That when you look at the church, what you see is a group of comfortable people leading convenient lives. And I'm wondering if that's true. Because if the gospel is anything, again, it's not convenient. It's simply not. The gospel that we have tells us that we should lay down our lives in order to take it to other people. The gospel says that we deny ourselves and follow him. Let me come full circle. We started off talking about the checkbook and the calendar. Is it possible that we have ordered our church life and our Christian life so that it is convenient for us to look after our children, to do things that we wouldn't like to do, to pay the occasional missionary 1% of our total income so they can go and do things that we would rather not do, so that we can have an easy life here? I wonder. I have 3 children. Lucy is 12. My son James is 10. I have another daughter who's 7 and a half, who has the most expressive face you've ever seen. We found this out late. She was deaf for part of her early life, and we only discovered that when her speech just clearly wasn't there. So she learned to talk with her face, to communicate to us. It's the most incredibly expressive and delightful face you could imagine. Now, I love my children. And because I'm away a lot, we often do things together. So let's suppose, you know, one of the things we love to do is we do all kinds of crazy things. I'm sure a lot of other people do. Camp in your backyard, sleep down in front of the coal fire we have in Oxford. We still burn coal in Oxford to stay warm. Go out on picnics. So let's suppose I've taken all the kids out on a picnic. We've had a good time. The kids have disappeared into the woods. So, at the end of the picnic, we start calling for the children. Lucy, James, Amelia, come back, we're going. Lucy appears. There's no James and there's no Amelia. We say, Lucy, where are they? They said, well, they went deep into the forest. So, we take Lucy, we go into the forest. Lucy, and we start calling, James, Amelia. It starts getting dark. We find James. Amelia, our most fiercely independent child, is still not present. It's now dark and it's cold. So what do? Do we go home? Oh, well, 2 out of 3 isn't bad. You win some, you lose some. It's awfully cold out here. We've got a nice coal fire back home. We will stay there until we find her dead or alive. That's the simple truth. Is it possible that in the Western world, we're struggling with the intellectual doubt about whether it's true, because we've never taken the time for proper discipleship to actually know that it is true? Is it possible that we're feeling morally ashamed? So we're not actually going out to those who are lost and perishing without the gospel, because we don't know how to properly explain this glorious gospel in all of its fullness, in order that we may not, again, be ashamed. Is it possible that actually all we're interested in is in ourselves, that we have a narcissistic gospel that revolves around us, our comfort and our ease? And regardless of the cost, we're not interested in going to tell anyone else. Is it possible, and I'd like to end with this question, that our gospel and by our gospel I mean the gospel, obviously, that may not actually be the true gospel at all, if this is what it has become, is a gospel that's left us so unmoved about the realities of heaven and hell that we heard about this morning that we won't go anywhere to do anything with anybody. Now, the trouble is that when we step out to do and respond in this way, what we discover is that the only safe place that we can actually be with God is to stay close to Him, regardless of where He may be sending us. Now, here's the point. The challenge of our gospel, the threat that we may feel in our hearts, the call, because threat isn't a good word, but it can feel like a threat, the call that we have may seem scary. And I am not suggesting by any means that therefore that we should be stupid, that we should be undiscerning, that we should be reckless in a sense of being biblically unwise. However, when God calls us somewhere, we should go and we should be attentive to His Spirit. And then if He for some reason closes the door, then by all means we may end up saying no, but we have to be absolutely sure that that's what He actually means. Because the only reason God didn't want me to be there at that place is not because He didn't want me to die. I am going to die. He knows when I'm going to die. It's just not there. It's going to be somewhere else. Now, I would like it to be when I'm sharing the gospel with some militant group. It could be that I'm going to die eating some errant pickle in Burger King. Now, I prefer option one to option two. Okay, if it was a question of preference, okay, option one is much more attractive to me than option number two. God knows exactly what it is, and we're not going to add a day to our life or lose a day from our life by doing anything that He's asked us to. So do not be afraid of going. All of the miraculous stories that you may hear from other parts of the world about how God has intervened in people's lives and turned situations around and sometimes done the most incredible thing, and I have seen many of those things, sometimes even with forms of prophetic assurance that have been startling. I can remember that debate I was telling you about earlier. I was in the car and I was terrified, and I was seriously wondering, because I'd brought my family and my children with me while I was about to do this debate, whether I was actually doing the right thing at all, given the fact these people had just blown up all these people just simply just a year before. And my wife touched me and she said, "Do you remember the church leaders who prayed for us in South Africa?" And I suddenly remembered that we'd been in South Africa 3 months before, and they said to us, "You're going to go to a place and you'll be surrounded by red and white flags, and you should have no fear in your heart." And we got the map out, as we did, after everyone left, and we looked at every country I was going to and every flag, and there wasn't a single one that was red or white. And I said to my wife, "Well, that doesn't make any sense. Maybe if we get an invitation from China, we should say yes." And here we are, we're in this country, we're driving down the street, and on every lamppost, in every shop window, and zigzagging across the road in the form of, do you use the term bunting? Little triangular flags that hang from string, what's that called? Bunting, okay. With these red and white flags. And Anne said to me, "Michael, do you see the flags?" And I looked out the window and I started crying. Then my wife said to the driver, "What are these red and white flags?" She said, "Oh, our local football team won a game yesterday and they put all the red and white flags up on the street." Now, is that because God doesn't want us to leave this planet at some point? Not at all. It's just that we're not going to die there. We're going to die somewhere else. Here's the final question I'd just like to ask in relationship to this thing about courage. And you've done very well in listening, and I'm sorry for the distraction of the blood. Although it seems like I'm now some kind of prophetic embellishment of blood on my hands. You should be glad that I don't spray while I talk. That could be interesting. I want to be careful how I ask this next question because I understand it could be taken in the wrong way, and with the wrong emphasis, this could get us into some trouble. So, again, I'm just have to displace my comments in light of the talk we've just had, and indeed the one before. But I would like to ask this question. Is it possible that if you were perfectly honest, you would say that you've been disappointed with your Christian life so far? That you rather thought there'd be more to it than this? That somehow you just thought there'll be more. At the center we run in Oxford, a guy applied to come and study with us some time ago. And I was interviewing him. I said, what did you do before you came here? Now, he used to work with an organization in England called the SAS, which are like our special armed services. So think Green Berets and basically Black Ops. And this guy was pretty good at what he did. He was actually head of covert operations in Afghanistan for a while in the recent war. And let's just say he's been to a lot of countries. I didn't even know Britain was actually militarily involved. Let's just leave it at that. So I said to him, why do you want to come and study with us? Why do you want to do apologetics? You've been involved in all this covert operation 17 and a half years. You've been working behind enemy lines. He said, well, I became a Christian a few years ago. He said, and when I was in special ops, he said, we used to work in small units, and we would do anything to accomplish the mission that we had been given. He said, there was no sacrifice that we could have been asked to make. There was nothing that we could be asked to do. There was nothing that was too dangerous that we could have been asked to complete that we weren't prepared to do. He said, we had each other's backs. We were totally committed to each other and to the mission because we believed in what we'd been asked to do and we believed in the importance of it. He said, now I've become a Christian. He says, the mission and the vision that God has given me is more important than anything any government has ever asked me to do. And here's my question, he said, where is the commitment in the church? Where is the willingness to suffer? Where is the willingness to pay the price? Where is the willingness to do that which is hard? Where is the willingness to lay down your life for it? He says, I don't see it. He said, we seem to be arguing about what kind of songs we should sing and whether we should have folding chairs or padded chairs or whatever kind of chairs. He said, it's killing me. He said, so I'd like to be training with you, and then I'd like to go to some of these countries you go to. So he did some training, and a little while later, we went to this particular country. I'll leave it unnamed. And as we were in the queue for going through customs control, I said to him, have you ever been here before? And he said, yes, but I've never been through passport control and customs. He was halo dropped in. We had 8 wonderful days. We had to dress in local dress. We met some interesting people, some of them violent people. And if you want to preach well, you should try preaching to an armed audience. I mean, it really does up the game. And we're sitting on the plane and we're flying back home 8 days later, and I turned to him and I said, well, was it worth it? And tears came to his eyes, and I'm always very moved when I see military men crying. Covert operations, black ops for 17 and a half years, that is a seriously long time. Seriously long, even to just have survived. And tears came to his eyes. He said, I feel like I'm alive again. He said, this is what I'm looking for. This is what I want to die for. To lay down my life sharing this gospel with other people. Is it possible that we've been trapped by shame? Is it possible we've been caught up in an affluent culture? Is it possible that God has so much more? Let me conclude with the Bible reading. For what shall I say? For time would fail to tell me of Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, of David, of Samuel, and the prophets, who through faith conquered kingdoms, enforced justice, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, quenched the power of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, were made strong out of weakness, became mighty in war, put foreign armies to flight. Women received back their children from the dead by resurrection. Isn't that amazing? Some were tortured, refusing to accept release so they might rise again to a better life. Others suffered mocking, flogging, chains, and imprisonment. They were stoned, they were sawn in two, they were killed with the sword. They went about in skins of sheep and goats, destitute, afflicted, mistreated, of whom the world is not worthy, wandering about in deserts and mountains and dens and caves of the earth. All these, though commended through their faith, did not receive what was promised, since God provided something better for us, that apart from that they should be made perfect. Therefore, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and sin which clings so closely, and let us run with endurance the race set before us, looking to Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God. And consider him who endured from sinners such hostility against himself, so that you may not grow weary or faint-hearted. If you only like the first half of that reading, I don't have a gospel for you. But if you liked all of that reading, then there is this glorious gospel. You may see the most amazing things, and it may well cost you your very life. I'm wondering if we could pray together. As a prayer, I would like to read a hymn. Some of you will know it, and I'm wondering if we could pray it. Lord, facing a task unfinished that drives us to our knees, a task that undiminished rebukes our faith, slothful ease. We who rejoice to know thee, renew before thy throne the solemn pledge we owe thee, to go and make thee known. Where other lords beside thee hold their unhindered sway, where forces that defy thee still today, with none to heed their crying for life and love and light, unnumbered souls are dying and pass into the night. So, Lord, we bear the torch that flaming fell from the hands of those who gave their lives proclaiming that Jesus died and rose. Ours is the same commission, the same glad measured hours, fired by the same ambition. To thee we yield our powers. O Father who sustained them, O Spirit who inspired, Savior whose love constrained them to toil with zeal untired, from cowardice defend us, from lethargy awake, forth on thy errand send us, to labor for thy sake. Amen.
Thank you for listening. Feel free to copy and distribute this message to others, but please do not charge for the content or alter it in any way. For more resources, go to desiringgod.org.